You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Atheistically Speaking, episode 53. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, I'd like to welcome back this week Ryan Bourne. You may remember him from such episodes as a few weeks ago. I don't know, whenever that was. How are you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing great, man. I'm excited to be back on the show with you.
I am very excited to have a more learned perspective on free will. It's a topic I'm really interested in, and based on the response, I think everyone's pretty interested in this one. I mean, who listens to these kinds of podcasts anyway? So I think it should be great. I learned a ton the last time you were on, and I think it could be even better this time. We'll see. So you have that to live up to. So don't, no pressure.
Right, yeah, thanks.
You're going to be like, free will.
Lower expectations.
Yeah. You're like, Webster's Dictionary defines free will as, and then you're like, that's all I have. That's all I got. I got that one thing. All right, so bad start. Skype cut out. I just told the funniest joke you've ever heard, Ryan. So get into character and give me a nice hearty...
I'm so sorry.
Oh, man, you are a terrible actor.
But
fortunately,
really
we don't have you on for your acting skills. We have you on.
Yeah, dude, yeah.
For your expertise in philosophy. And is free will... I'm blanking right now. Is that not your specific area of study, of course, but is it among one of your more familiar ones?
All right, good. So this is my opportunity to lower expectations. So last time I was on the show, we were talking about moral philosophy, and I told you that was not my specialty. It's
right.
Something that I studied at a high level, as anybody who goes on to study philosophy in grad school will. But I didn't focus on that specifically. I was more interested in philosophy of mind, consciousness, you know, stuff like that. Now, when I entered grad school, I thought free will was the ticket, man. As you already pointed out, this is a hot topic. It's hot in the sciences. It's hot in legal debates, right, since free will is closely connected to concerns about responsibility. So, yeah, when I entered grad school, I was like, this is the thing to study, you know. And yeah. What happened is I got into some other areas. But I did take several courses with a notable figure in the philosophy of free will named Eddie Namias. And listeners may recognize his name from the debate between Dennett and Harris, because Dennett cites some of Namias's research in his critique of Harris's book Free Will. Harris offers a response to it. It's also worth noting that in the book Free Will itself, Harris quotes some stuff from Namias. Eddie Namias had a piece in the Opinionator blog, or I think it's the Stone blog over at New York Times, talking about free will and the view of a number of neuroscientists, right, Harris included, that we don't have free will. And this is, you know, based on recent findings in the brain and cognitive sciences, including, you know, the possibility particularly, right, as Harris points to, and you talked about it a good bit last time when you were discussing Benjamin Libet, or it's Libet, it's like a French term, his research.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right, so this concern about neuroprediction. So again, just so that I'm not an expert exactly, it wasn't my area of expertise, but I did study with a notable figure whose work did come up in the exchange between Harris and Dennett.
Sure, his name does definitely seem familiar to me, I think mainly in Dennett.
So having studied with Eddie, I did a lot of coursework with him, as a matter of fact. I'm pretty familiar with his work, his perspective as a compatibilist, who is very interested in doing work on ordinary, everyday people's intuitions about free will, because this is stuff that comes up in the debate. As a matter of fact, Harris believes that his definition of free will is based on a popular conception of free will. In other words, what ordinary people think free will is, right? And as it turns out, Namias believes that Harris and so many other scientists who deny the existence of free will have a mistaken understanding of what free will is. And the mistake begins with wrongly attributing this overly strong, ultimately impossible conception of free will to ordinary everyday people. So that's what I want to talk about with you, getting into like specifics, particular authors and their views is the stuff that Eddie Namias has said. And we're going to situate this within the context of two much broader questions. The first one, right, that we have to answer in the free will debate is what is free will, right? And once we've got that sorted out, then we can ask whether we have it. Well, as it turns out, you've got folks like Sam Harris and other free will skeptics who say, we don't have free will. And then on the other hand, you've got compatibilists, Eddie Namias, Daniel Dennett, who say that actually we do have free will. And the disagreement about whether we have it, it turns out, begins with a disagreement about what free will is. And while neither side, the compatibilists who say we have it or the incompatibilists like Harris who say that we don't, while neither side would make an argument like this, intuitively free will is X, right? Or most people believe that free will is X. We don't have X or we do have X, therefore people have free will. Nobody makes an argument like that. However, both sides do claim that their understanding of free will is intuitive to ordinary everyday people. Other figures in the free will debate who would fall sort of on Harris's side of things, the free will skeptics, they often say things like people are natural incompatibilists. That is to say, people naturally believe that free will is incompatible with determinism, and this particular conception of free will that people naturally have is one that is contra-causal, right? It's where, despite past events and the laws of nature, right, this long chain of cause and effect that's come before us, despite that, right, at the moment of decision, the moment of choice, we have, alternate possibilities, a genuinely open future where we have two paths available to us. And if that's really what people believe, right, is that we do have a genuinely open future. We have alternative possibilities here at the moment of choice. If that's generally, they think, what free will is, well, determinism says, no, actually, you don't have that, right? We don't have alternative possibilities. And this, again, is the conception of free will that Harris, individuals like Robert Kane is a philosopher who takes a similar perspective, not quite the same as Harris's, but still an incompatibilist one. This is what they think most people believe about free will. And they believe that because of this, that the burden of proof, so to speak, is on compatibilists, right? And if compatibilists start saying, no, that's an insane notion of free will, it needs to be something like this, then you get complaints like Harris raised towards Dennett. He's like, look, that's like saying people believe in Atlantis, right? But actually, Atlantis is the island of, like, Sicily, I think is what he said.
Right.
And once we take and, properly sort of revise and hone and correct every people's everyday ordinary views, then we'll have, the correct sort of view. And he's like, no, dude, they think Atlantis exists and Atlantis doesn't exist. That's how it goes. In the same way, Harris is thinking people believe that free will requires, like, miraculous dualist sort of powers or something. We don't have those, therefore we don't have free will. But again, the question is, well, do ordinary everyday people actually think that? So I would ask you, because I'm going to take you as the authority here on Harris's book, because I have not read it, right? And before your listeners get like raged out over that, this is not a show like the last one where it was moral philosophy and the moral landscape, where if I'd come on last time and never read Harris's book, that would have been like a big deal.
It would have been very impressive that you won the essay contest not having read the book. I would have been quite impressed. Of course, I wasn't at all expecting you to have read it. I want to hear about your expertise sort of apart from, the show I did. So sorry, what is the question?
The question then about Harris here is, I believe I got him right. I haven't read the book, but I've looked at, reviews of it. I've read his response to Dennett. Mm-hmm. I've looked at some quotes from the text. Have I got this right here, as Harris's critics are saying, that Harris believes that the popular conception of free will, the everyday ordinary conception of free will, is this incompatibilist one where we have an open future, right? Radically open despite all that's come before us, right? We can break free of past events and the laws of nature in some sort of miraculous contra-causal way. Is this the view that Harris has, that that's the popular conception of free will?
I'd say so. I think that I might not be able to put it in the best words, but another topic he brings up, and feel free to, you know, we can talk about this later, but something that I'm not totally sure how it squares exactly with these definitions is that Harris does a lot of talking in his book about how thoughts occur to us sort of out, like we can't think them, we can't intentionally think them. Like if he does an example, did you listen to the episode, right? I forget.
Sure. Oh yeah.
The thing about trying to think of a city, it's like, well, why do you think of that city? Our thoughts occur behind the scenes. We don't know where they come from. I'm not totally sure how this factors into the definition, but I would say that it factors in somewhere. Yeah. But I think you're right that he thinks that Dennett's version of free will is not the one that everyone feels like they have.
Right. Right. So what I gathered from your two episodes, which were excellent.
Oh, thank you.
I know you talk about how you're, you know, an amateur or something, but your analysis was good, I believe. Your listeners shouldn't worry that you're like radically misinforming them about this debate.
All right, I'm going to need you to sign some paperwork to notarize this
certificate.
Yeah.
You know,
you heard of Ryan Bourne? Yeah, I got the Ryan Bourne certificate. Yeah, certificate of I kind of know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
that's pretty. Everyone who visits, I'll be like, yeah, you see that up there? Yeah, I kind of know what I'm talking about.
You can quote me. That can be like a blurb on your blog.
Oh, if I ever write a terrible book, I'm getting you. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. And then this is the part where you tear apart whatever I was saying, right?
No, not at all. Right? I thought it was a solid show.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm glad that folks who, you know, didn't get degrees in philosophy or aren't actively doing academic philosophy are interested enough in this stuff to really put in the time to study on it, talk about it, start conversations with other lay people about this. And it's especially encouraging when those are pretty good conversations, right?
You're too kind.
So what I gathered from your show, as well as from Harris's response to Dennett, Dennett's critique, of course, Eddie Namias wrote a review of Harris's book. I read that as well. What I gathered from all of that is that there's kind of two components to Harris's defense of this particular conception of free will, the incompatibilist conception of free will. He's got, on the one hand, discussion of our first-person experience of free will. And he even uses this phrase, first person, right, to describe a psychological fact about our experience. That our experience is this. We take ourselves to be, right, the origin, right? Our conscious thoughts, feelings, stuff like that, we take these to be the origin of our actions, of our choices. So he's on the one hand appealing to experience, and he's talking about stuff like thoughts arising from, you know, I don't want to say as if from nowhere, but thoughts arising sort of unbidden. And you gave the example of, you know, coming home from like a party or an event. We were having a conversation, and maybe you thought you could have done better in that conversation, but it wasn't something that you were like ruminating about at the moment. But boom, something pops into your head. The French even have like a phrase for this.
Oh, really?
Like, and I should totally know what the French is. That. This is such a letdown that I don't. It has something. It's like escalator or something.
Oh, okay. I think it's something like le thought coming into your head for no reason. Something. Yeah.
I know the translation is literally staircase wit, right?
Wow. Interesting.
It's like you're down the staircase, you've left the party, and then it comes to
you. Oh, I love that.
The correct thing. Yeah.
I absolutely love that. That is so cool.
If we could just convert that to like.
Oh, here, Google Translate.
so he's got that, and you said, yeah, we have this sort of experience that, you know, thoughts come unbidden. Mm-hmm. And this could be very well a sort of psychological fact about our experience, right? Another appeal that he makes here is to thought experiments, right? Not just, you know, asking people to introspect on the way that their minds work, but to think about particular imaginary scenarios, in particular one where the sort of technology that we get kind of a glimpse of, with the Libet experiments or Libet experiments. I'm going to say Libet like you. I like that better. It sounds French.
It's, yeah. Who knows? We could both be so wrong.
And then more. Well, at least we can say Pigliucci, correct?
Yeah.
I was going to say. That.
Let's ask Pigliucci how to pronounce Libet.
he would probably know, right? Yeah. So he also gives the neuro prediction thing, which we can relate to real world stuff, the Libet experiments where certain, you know, neural potential, like a potential signal that's detectable with electroencephalographs, EEGs, reliably predicts, because it reliably precedes our report of deciding to flick our wrist or something. So what he tells us to do, right, this little thought experiment, is just imagine that neuroscientists have developed this technology to the fullest, where they can predict everything that you're going to do with 100% accuracy by scanning your brain. And the intuition that he believes this pumps, right, to use Dennett's description mm-hmm. of these things, thought experiments as intuition pumps, the intuition that he believes this pumps is that, oh, wow, we don't actually have free will, because, you know, all of this stuff is coming prior to our conscious experience and what we would take to be our conscious control over this stuff. It seems like, I think, again, the intuition he's trying to pump, it seems like real causes of what we do are not us. They are prior to us. They are outside of our awareness. And more than that, when we take and push this way, way back with the standard determinism argument, they are well beyond our control, because they're part of a chain of events that goes back prior to our birth and to the very beginning of the universe.
Do you mind if I stop you for a sec here?
Yeah, sure.
Because I kind of want – I actually don't know. I'm kind of seeking some clarification. Do you see that as a separate issue from the typical free will, as in to say it may be that our thoughts and our sources of our thoughts were entirely conscious to us, but we could still not have free will, right? Like if we decided our definition and was in some way that, you know, it's all determined, even though it's conscious to us, it's still all determined to the point where we didn't feel like we had free will, or vice versa, you know. So is the idea of thoughts coming to a sudden bidden staircase wit, is that a separate problem from a lot of these classic ones?
I think so. And it's good that you bring that up to create these distinctions. I might have got a little ahead of myself because we could really just sort of isolate the neuro prediction thing and the prior to conscious awareness. We could isolate that.
Right. So, and let me just ask you
of determinism, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Sorry. Let me just ask you. So would you think if it was proven, I don't think it is. And I think those, you know, there's still science to be done, and I'm not entirely sure of those experiments. I don't have a ton of confidence in them, but if it was proven that someone could know what your decision is going to be a good deal before you were consciously aware of it, would that threaten even Dennett's conception of free will? And if I'm getting ahead of where you want to be, don't feel free to.
No, this is good. So, just to make sure we're clear where we're at.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
This is a complicated discussion. Yep, right?
Definitely.
And it sometimes, because of that, it might not come out as well organized as we hope.
Yeah.
But you're here to check me.
I'm trying.
That. So that's good.
it is very, 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 very complicated. So go ahead.
So we got on the one hand the experience of conscious will. We've got on the other hand prediction of our conscious choices and actions. So with the prediction part, would this threaten even a compatibilist conception of free will of the sort that Dennett endorses? No, I don't think so, right? Because on the compatibilist side, it gets the name from the claim that it's compatible with determinism, right? And you were thinking, well, are we really talking about determinism? It sounds like conscious versus unconscious here. For the compatibilist, what tends to matter, right, most conception of compatibilism, like Dennett endorses and like Namias endorses, is that our conscious deliberations play a causal role in our actions. Right? That's their concern.
But isn't that contradict this? Or
no, not necessarily, right? Just because we are unaware of certain events that precede our conscious choices, that doesn't render our conscious choices somehow epiphenomenal, right? Mm. In other words, the conscious choice could itself be a sort of final or near to final link in the causal chain that leads to our action,
okay.
right? Just because there are previous events, neural events of which we are unaware that are also in this causal chain and for which we are not ultimately responsible, right? That doesn't undermine a causal role for our conscious deliberations further down in the chain, nearer to the choice that we make or the action
okay.
that we take.
I think that would definitely, I may need to be specific in the wording because I did word it as though someone would know your choice before you were aware of making it. So that to me would suggest right. that there isn't really a conscious deliberation that has any effect on the overall choice. But I think that was maybe simplified language on my part, because if we're talking about a simple pick left or right, you know, like there's not that much deliberation. It may have to do with the level of complexity of deliberation yeah. that they're even able to observe and that kind of thing. Oh. So if we're taking it to mean that it could know your entire, like the end of your decision before you do, no matter what the decision, then I would think that would probably contradict that conception, don't you think?
It sounds like the conclusion that you want to draw here is there are neural events of which we're unaware that always precede conscious choices or decisions. Do we conclude from that then the conscious choices that come afterwards play no causal role in our decisions? Is that the conclusion that you're drawing based on the fact that we can predict those conscious choices due to those neural events?
Maybe. Yeah, I just want to outline sort of like when you're in a religion debate, you're like, okay, what would change your mind? I'm trying to outline what would affect Dennett's conception or a compatibilist conception of free will. Like what would prove to them we have no free will? I don't know.
If it were the case, right? So here again is a sort of a necessary condition for free action that compatibilists like Dennett and Namias would set. They would say it is necessary, right, for an action to be free. It's not sufficient, but it's necessary that our conscious choices, our deliberation, right, sort of process of deciding that we might go through, or other mental events that we take to matter to our choices and actions. It's necessary that they play a causal role.
Okay.
Right? If it turned out that consciousness plays no causal role whatsoever, that it is epiphenomenal, as philosophers and scientists would say. If it plays no causal role whatsoever, then no, we don't have free will on a compatibilist conception.
Okay.
Right? And there is, right, an argument for that. There is an incompatibilist, a scientist named Daniel Wegener. And I would bet dollars to donuts that Harris cites Wegener's work in his book. Because Wegener wrote a book back in 2002, and he's published many papers on the topic, called The Illusion of Conscious Will. And he's one of the few scientists who has done some work on the experience of free will, right? And this is important to note because, you know, Harris talks about it and sort of offers generalizations about what the experience of free will looks like. But I'm not sure what he's basing that on other than introspection of his own experience, right? Mm-hmm. And if this is a claim, if he's trying to put forward a psychological fact about human beings, then I would think that we need to engage in some scientific work to determine that, empirical psychology specifically. I don't know that he cites any of that, but we can at the very least, right, get into some of what Wegener does, because he has been trying to investigate what the experience of conscious willing is like. And he's conducted a number of experiments that he believes show that our conscious choices, our conscious experience, our conscious feeling of willing, it's quite possible that it plays no role at all. Mm-hmm. And the explanation would be this. It would be that we've got neural mechanisms that take and govern both mental and physical activity. And so mental and physical activity are like the outputs of the neural processes, right? We've got the neural machinery, the hardware or wetware or whatever. It's running some programs that are written by our genes and modified by our environment and stuff. And the output of this is, of course, our actions. But additionally, it outputs sort of like a report, you know, which is our conscious experience. And this conscious experience reliably sort of tracks or precedes our actions. Right. Mm. So, for instance, let's say that you're like, I'm going to demonstrate that I have free will. Watch me go. And you raise your hand and you're like, check it out. Now I'm going to show you I got free will some more. And then you lower your hand. Okay. So what's going on here? You, right, have certain thoughts, intentions, and they proceed. Right? What happens? Your hand going up. More than that, these thoughts and intentions are consistent with what happens. So you're monitoring the action. You're like, yeah, I was like telling my hand to go up, and it did. Right? What's another aspect of this, because I'm laying out for you here now, like the three sort of components of conscious willing, as Wegener understands them. We've got priority. The intentions come first. We've got consistency, right? They accord with the action as we observe it. Mm-hmm. And then we've got exclusivity. Right, we are unaware of, apparently have no reason to attribute our actions to other causes. So when you're raising your hand, you got priority. The intention comes before the action. You've got consistency. Yeah, you've got consistency. Right, so you're monitoring things are consistent with your intention.
Yeah, it's not like sometimes we say I'm going to raise my hand and we kick our foot, you know, that kind of thing.
And you've got exclusivity too. Because what you're aware of here is the intention, right? You're not aware of other potential causes. You don't see somebody grabbing your arm and raising it, for instance. And you are most certainly not aware of any of the neural events that precede it and that are detectable by the sort of technology that LeVay had used in his experiment, right? And he has conducted, Wegener has conducted a number of ingenious experiments. And there are short papers out there. If people just Google Daniel Wegener, they can look at some of this stuff. Ingenious experiments where... he can create the illusion of conscious willing, where the individual, the research subject, is not actually involved in it at all. So let me give you just one example here,
please,
for consistency, right? This sort of coordination between what you're thinking and what you're observing, what's happening here. People have seen this sort of stuff before. He did this weird thing like with hands, right? So you've got a pair of disembodied hands, and this is not like literally disembodied, but the body is concealed, the hands are exposed, and you've got a participant that's observing this little hand show, right? And you provide the participants with some headphones, and over the headphones they will hear instructions that are then carried out by these hands that they're observing, right? And the control condition here is to have the participants observing the hands moving without the headphones. So they don't have instructions, laying out what the hands are going to do. When the participants are watching the little hand show and they hear these instructions, which will always, they'll be prior, so we could talk about priority here too. But they hear these instructions like, so now, you know, wave the hands left or right, or now do goofy jazz hands. When a participant was hearing these instructions and observing the movements of the hands that were coordinated with them, consistent with this, just like the raising of your hand would be consistent with your inner instruction or intention, people had a stronger sense. They reported a stronger sense of having control over that, right? Now, it wasn't like I literally felt like those were my hands. No, it wasn't that strong, right? But there was this experience of a greater degree of control there, right? This is just one thing that he did for the consistency condition. When it comes to priority, he did something a little different. You'd have a participant sitting at a computer, and they'd have like some icons on screen. For instance, there'd be a swan icon, and again, they've got like stuff that they would listen to. In this case, they would hear a tape recording of the word swan, and when they hear this tape recording of the word swan, and then the mouse is moved to click on the swan icon, they reported that they did this, right? They were responsible for and control of the moving of the mouse. As it turns out, though, they really weren't.
So they're not even, it's just moving by itself. Do they have like a fake mouse? Or
there's an experimental confederate who was sort of gently nudging their hand in the same way you'd have, you know, you go to what, like a BS seance or something where you have a Ouija board, right?
Okay.
And who's moving it? Ghosts? No. You know, but there's going to be somebody in the group, right, who's in on the trick and is moving, right, moving a little Ouija board thing. Mm-hmm. Here, there's an experimental confederate who is, unbeknownst to the research participant, gently sort of nudging their hand in order to do it. I haven't looked at the exact details of that because I haven't seen the research paper. I looked at a summary of a number of experiments and a chapter that he composed in an anthology. So I think with you, I'd be curious to see more of the details about this experimental Confederate and how they nudged the hand, right? But that's the way it was supposed to work. The person did not actually move the mouse, but they reported the experience of controlling the movement of the mouse. And the explanation here, according to Wegner, is not that they actually moved it, because he says they didn't. An experimental Confederate gently nudged their hand. But rather, it was the priority of this swan message, right, where the recording stands in for a sort of conscious intention in the same way with the magic hands experiment, right? The recording of instructions is something that sort of stood in for that inner dialogue where we'd be thinking about what we're doing. So there's a whole host of experiments like this where he's like, I can produce the experience of conscious willing, right? I can control it by controlling these three factors here: priority, consistency, and exclusivity. So the conclusion is, because we can take and manipulate people's conscious experience, we can give them, right, through experimental manipulations in the laboratory, give them the illusion of willing. This opens the possibility that when, you know, out there outside of the laboratory, we're doing stuff, that this likewise is an illusion, right? So that's like definitely one way we can think of it here. And again, the this is not to say that there aren't actually thoughts. This is not to deny that there's some conscious stuff going on. The claim is that it's not actually causing what we do, but instead could just be kind of an additional output of these neural mechanisms that are controlling everything. This additional output is prior to, it's consistent with, and it's apparently exclusive, right? Because we don't have access, conscious access to all that neural stuff, right, that's going on prior to this, all those additional causes we don't have. But those neural mechanisms, again, that control the consciousness, control the actions, they're spitting out this little extra thing. And we mistakenly think that to be the cause, this extra little conscious report that tracks with everything. We think that's what's causing stuff, but it's really not. Right, it's just something sort of like a label that we slap on it, and it's just I wouldn't say it's coincidence, because it's not like chance, but it's kind of like in the same way everywhere your car goes, right? What color is your car, Thomas?
Silver.
Your car is silver. Everywhere your car goes, man, the silver goes. Right? Mm-hmm. Is the silver of your car causing it to move? No. Right? It's just this sort of veneer or this kind of polish that's on top of it. It's epiphenomenal. Right? It plays no causal role whatsoever in the movement of your car, but it is always there. Right?
I would
the same
be
way, this consciousness stuff is supposed to be always there because it's spit out by the same mechanisms that are actually driving our choices and driving our actions.
So, and maybe this isn't something you know, but I would be very curious what his view would be on why we would have evolved such a consciousness. Why would we even have this consciousness if it sounds like we would be exactly the same if we were not at all, if we were just almost a machine, you know, and there's no memory dump, you know, like a report, you know, batch report file going into our brain.
Yeah. Okay. So first let me just modify my car thing a little bit. I think the paint works, but we could also talk about like the noise that your car makes or the exhaust that it puts out. All of these things, again, very reliably track with the operation of your car, but they're not actually causing it to go.
Sure.
Now you're raising here what is a common objection to the claim that consciousness is epiphenomenal, right? This does not fit with our understanding of the human brain and its outputs, including consciousness, right? As being the product of evolution. You know, it seems like consciousness is like kind of a big deal, you know? Why would evolution take and invest, right, in invest resources, right? Because I imagine there's a lot of stuff in our brains, right, sucking up a lot of energy to take and spit out something to do nothing. Why would that happen, right? So you got individuals like John Searle, who's a philosopher, is, you know, deep into the philosophy of mind stuff and free will stuff, who raises that very objection. He's like, this doesn't fit with a scientific naturalistic understanding of the mind and consciousness, namely, you know, one that says that this stuff was evolved.
Can I make a little point here?
Yeah, go. Yeah.
Now, I want to make a tiny point of clarification of just saying I could imagine that evolution, because I've thought about this a lot before, because it's really interesting. It's the same a topic right now as that terrible movie about using 10% of your brain. It's a it's the same thing. Like, okay, so we just evolved this giant resource heavy, you know, thing. It takes a ton of energy that we have to eat that much more food for and maintain and all that. Yeah. And we're only just using 10% of it just because. So that, it's sort of like that. But I've thought about this a lot, and I could imagine consciousness being something that evolved to improve deliberation. So it would allow you to make better decisions.
Yeah.
But it could still be entirely deterministic and entirely almost inevitable, you know, like so I could imagine that being, to use a weird mixture of words, compatible with a not free will, compatible with us not having free will. But I think I've never heard of these Wegener experiments, and those to me make it sound like the consciousness is not even helping deliberation. It's not even doing anything. It's like this thing that's just around that takes
that's,
some of
the, so that's, yeah, that's the, that is the conclusion ultimately
okay.
I'm wanting to press here.
Gotcha.
And, you know, he uses the same sort of phrasing that others do, that conscious will is an illusion. But for him, it goes pretty deep, man. He's saying conscious will is itself inert, right?
Wow.
Now, he says that he's kind of, make sure I don't want to, like, you know, distort the guy's view here. When you read his work, he'll tell you, I've set aside the question of whether mental event consciousness actually caused things. He says that he's not really taking a position on that. At the same time, though, he thinks that he's opening up the possibility that consciousness really doesn't do anything, right? So he says, I haven't offered a conclusive answer to the question of whether consciousness plays a causal role in our behavior. However, right, he thinks that he's opened up a sort of room for the view that consciousness doesn't play any role at all. All right. And if that's where things go, that's a big payoff. And again, you were asking, you know, what would it take to undermine a compatibilist notion of free will? Because, you know, for compatibilist, determinism isn't going to do it, because free will and determinism are compatible,
yeah.
Right? And I said, well, you know, here you go. This would be it if it turns out that consciousness does buckus, right?
Because
the compatibilist says that consciousness plays a role, plays a crucial role. Because it's, you know, it's within consciousness where we're deliberating, we're thinking, right? Now, all of that stuff could be determined. And compatibilists are like, that's totally cool. That's fine, right? They say that what matters, right, the proper conception of free will is not that it be, you know, an exercise of miraculous sort of power, a little miracle. You offered a quote last time from Roger Chisholm, who's a philosopher who endorses a libertarian view.
Oh, good. I forgot his name, but I'm glad you know it.
It's not an easy one to remember, Roderick Chisholm, right?
Well, I'll remember it forever now.
But, you know, an even tastier quote from Chisholm is not the little miracle one, but where he says that, you know, if I've got things right, and his view is it's a specific type of libertarianism called I want to call it agent causationism, but I'm putting isms on everything, and this I feel bad about this sometimes. He proposes that proposes a whole new kind of causation in the universe called agent causation.
Right.
So this he contrasts with event causation. You have neural events, brain stuff, right, that causes conscious activity, right, that causes all these other things, and this is all event causation. He wants to say that there are additionally agents that exist in the world, and that they cause things. Apart from events, right? That agents can like take and just kind of swoop down into the chain of causal events, and, you know, get some new stuff going on. And he said, if this is the case, right? If we have free will, and what free will requires, in his view, Chisholm, is that we be agent causes, then it's not just little miracles that happen, right? We are ourselves unmoved movers. We're like God, him, her, itself, where God is supposed to be the creator, the sort of first cause of all things. We are, as agent causes, not the first causes of the entire universe, but we can take and start entirely new causal chains where we break free from our determined past and just, boom, start some new stuff here. That's, again, one type of libertarian view. And compatibilists are like, that is not at all what free will is or needs to be. Okay. And that's the thing when, you know, again, this comes back to definitions, right? The terms compatibilism and incompatibilism point to disagreement about whether determinism is compatible with free will. Well, what does this disagreement turn on? It's not the definition of determinism that philosophers or scientists are up in arms about, right? It's the definition of free will, what it comes down to. And well, what definition do we adopt? And you've got both sides here, again, as I was saying at the start, trying to appeal to an ordinary, everyday conception of it. And you've got on the one hand, right, what we take our everyday experience of free will to be, and the research on this. And if this is a scientific question, this is empirical stuff, man. Since this is psychology, we should be able to do some, you know, psychological experiments about it. There's limited research when it comes to our experience of conscious willing, but Wegner is somebody who is trying to get into the stuff, so that's cool.
Yeah.
And there's also limited research when it comes to our intuitions about these sort of thought experiments, like Harris proposes, his neuroprediction experiment, right? This is where Namias comes in, right? He was like, what is this, these incompatibilists claiming that ordinary everyday people have this notion of free will where we're like unmoved movers or other just like far out impossible stuff, you know? He's like, do everyday ordinary people think that? So Namias started doing some research on this about 10 years ago. And according to his work, where he does something very similar to what Harris likes to do, presenting these sort of thought experiments, these imagine that. Well, he presents those in controlled settings and collects data on it. Harris has not done that, right? When he tells you this is the everyday ordinary conception of free will, this is what most people think, he's not basing that on systematic observation experimentation. So while he's making a claim about human psychology, he's claiming to put forward here statements of psychological fact, he hasn't actually done science that would appear to be required to make those statements of fact. And ironically, you've got philosophers, right? Not the sort that are typically doing empirical investigation that are coming in here to pick up the slack, right? Including Namias with his work and the seminal study. And this is the one that Dennett cited in his response to Harris and that Harris dismissed in his response to Dennett. A seminal study by Namias on this stuff called Surveying Freedom. And he's like, incompatibilists think that ordinary everyday people have this really metaphysically demanding understanding of free will, right? Where we can break free from the chain of determinism or some kind of stuff like that. And he's like, okay, well, let's check this out. One thing that we can't do in this research, right, is just ask people, are you an incompatibilist, right? What do you think about determinism? That's not going to work because these are terms of art, right? These are technical terms that philosophers use. And more than that, it wouldn't be appropriate to do regardless because to say that people are natural or intuitive incompatibilists is to say that these are their sort of intuitions coming in to the debate, right? Before you even present them with philosophical arguments one way or the other, their natural or intuitive stance is going to be aligning with these things. It's not to say that they know the terms or would use the terms properly, but that they would have a sort of conceptual alignment with what the incompatibilists say. So importantly, with these experiments, it's not some sort of crude asking people what they think about determinism. Instead, what you have to do is what Harris was doing. Present people with sort of like deterministic scenarios, right? And you see what sort of judgments do they make. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the stuff from the Surveying Freedom paper. And again, this is the one that that Dennett cited. Harris didn't find it compelling. And this is like a seminal paper in a field that's broadly called experimental philosophy, where you've got philosophers making claims about what everyday ordinary people's intuitions are. Right? Most of the time, they haven't actually done any research about that. They just think that everybody else's intuitions are going to be the same as theirs. Well, let's do some research.
Right. I'm very in favor of this. It sounds like fascinating research.
I mean, if you love science, right, this sounds like an opportunity to really get some science involved in our philosophical debates, right? There's worries sometimes that we can't bring the two together on some questions, right? But here we go, right? So here's one scenario. You mentioned last time, or your last episode about this, you talked about determinism, causal determinism. You talked about Laplacian determinism, right? Laplace's demon who can predict all this sort of stuff. So what Namias and his fellow researchers did is they presented their subjects with a little scenario where you've got this guy, Jeremy, and he he lives in a world, a future possible world, where we have a supercomputer like Laplace's daemon that can take, and based on past events and the laws of nature, deduce everything that's going to happen now and in the future. So you've got here in this context, that's what's been described to the subjects now, the supercomputer, right? Laplace's daemon in computer form. You got this guy, Jeremy. He's born, right? Supercomputer predicted that. Then, like 20 years later, at a specific time, a specific date, a specific location, he robs a bank, right? Computer predicted that too. And people are then asked, do you think that Jeremy robbed this bank of his own free will? Right, so we've got Laplace's daemon in supercomputer form here. We've got this perfect prediction in a deterministic universe here. What do people think? Does Jeremy have free will? Well, as it turns out, nearly 80% of participants said, yeah, he's got free will.
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard the details of this, but that when I hear that question, not having heard it before, despite the priming of the computer predicting everything, it still sounds like, oh, no one held a gun to his head. That's what that sounds like to me. And I, you know, of course, I'm not going to speak for every layperson, but I could imagine that that might be what people are thinking. Like, no one forced him to do it.
Well, then that sounds like that would be a compatibilist concern then.
Simply that no one's forcing you to do something gives you free will?
Roughly speaking. Look, here's what an incompatibilist says. Free will and determinism are incompatible. Well, let's present people with a deterministic scenario and ask whether this person has free will. That's precisely what we've done here. What would the incompatibilist view predict? Well, the incompatibilist view is that people are natural incompatibilists. Their intuitive view should be that when a person is acting within a deterministic scenario, they do not have free will. Right? So if it is in fact the case that people are natural incompatibilists, then presented with a deterministic scenario like this, where the supercomputer says, you know, we can take and predict this all because it's a deterministic universe, people should say, no, he does not have free will. Instead, a majority of people say, yes, he does have it.
Well, the only problem there that I would wonder about is that people don't have an everyday conception of free will that in the same way that I think philosophers reason about. I mean, I think that it's more of like a legal thing. It's like, oh, no one forced him to do it. He did it himself. I mean, I think that, so I don't know. I want to say many things about this. You might be right. I mean, technically speaking, I guess if you are given the situation where a computer can predict everything and you answer that someone still has free will, I guess technically that makes you a compatibilist, but I would be worried that they're thinking about, so as far as determinism goes or incompatibilism, are there incompatibilists who say there's no difference between an action and an action under duress? Like they think there's no difference at all between those things?
Harris seemed to suggest something like that, except for him, it wasn't a matter of external manipulation, like a gun to the head. Instead, it was a tumor to your brain. And he wanted to say that there was no difference between abnormal neuroanatomy and normal anatomy.
Right?
Now, your concern here is not with internal biological differences, but external social differences, right?
Even if I believe there was no free will, I would still believe there's a difference between, an action done by yourself and an action done by someone else forcing you to do something. There's some sort of difference there, and I would argue that that could be what people are talking about when they're answering this question. That would be my only concern.
Okay. Well. First of all, I don't think compatibilists disagree about manipulation, right? Compatibilists and compatibilists would both say that manipulation, coercion taken undermine free will. The difference between them is whether determinism undermines free will. All right. So, is that a straightforward enough answer to your question there about what incompatibilists think and compatibilists think here about manipulation? They agree that it interferes with, not free will in the contra-causal sense, because they still disagree about that. But they would agree that there is a difference, right? And it would make a difference in court. Right, it'd be a legal difference here between being forced to do something with a gun to your head and doing something without a gun to your head. Right,
right. Yeah. And I just think that it's probably not something we can answer without further questioning of you know people. But I would be worried that they're just keeping in mind that legal sort of definition and not actually answering some deeper question.
Here's what I might do with that, right? Because this is a question about what people's natural views are.
Yeah.
And we want to be careful when we're testing it not to sort of sway or infect those natural untutored views with philosophical argumentation, because that wouldn't be a proper test of the claim that incompatibilists are making. They're saying people are, you know, naturally disposed to this particular view of free will, namely that it's incompatible with determinism. It sounds like what you're suggesting here is that what's coming out in this particular experiment, and there are many more, I'll see how many I can get in here for you. what's coming out here is still not an untutored conception of free will. Rather, it's a conception of free will that has been shaped by our familiarity with the legal
system. Let me put a finer point on that. I would be worried that it's not even answering the question. It's simply for totally untrained people in philosophy, they're answering a separate question of free, you know, a free action versus an unfree action that might not really say anything about the philosophical question of free will. Possibly that would be my worry with this. I'm not saying for sure that that's true, but that was my first
kind of clarify for me then what you take the philosophical question to be.
I think that regardless of whether or not you believe in free will, I think there's still a difference between doing something and being coerced to do something. And I think that that might be the only part they're thinking of if they're just talking about, did he do this under his own free will?
Well, if we can't figure out whether people are incompatibilists by presenting them with a deterministic scenario and then asking whether the person has free will, how would we do it?
Yeah, I don't know. I could try to think about it, but it would not be very interesting to sit here in silence for a few minutes.
Yeah, I worry that you're maybe demanding too much here with this particular criticism.
Okay.
The concern that critics raise with Namias' research and that they try to address is that determinism itself is not salient enough. That's perhaps a different way to put your concern here, right? Broadly, you're worried that we're not really addressing the philosophical debate, all right? And we can put a finer point on that, as you've been trying to do, but in a different way. Put a finer point on that and say, well, the determinism isn't really coming out to them here, right? If you want to frame the concern that way, that is a concern that is very often raised here, right? And it's one that, you know, what Namias and them say is, okay, well, if you're worried that our particular experimental materials haven't turned up the determinism knob enough, right, this variable isn't really coming through, then, take and come up with some more experiments, right?
Yeah.
Because what we seem to agree to here is that insofar as people on either side of the debate, incompatibilists and compatibilists, are going to appeal to people's ordinary everyday intuitions, are going to claim, right, that it's a psychological fact, as Harris has, that people are natural incompatibilists. This is an empirical question, right, subject to systematic experimentation and observation. Harris does not have that stuff, hasn't done it, right? Here on the other side of the debate, we've got compatibilists like Namias in particular who are trying to do it.
Well, of course, and I respect that. And I meant to say earlier that I think maybe we're putting a little too much on what this popular conception is, aren't we? I mean, I would be perfectly happy to talk about what the definition should be and see if something satisfies that. But I also would say that it would be very curious. And tell me if I'm wrong here, but it would be very curious if the problem of free will has been something that's recognized to be a problem for millennia, right? I mean, it's one of the oldest philosophical problems. It would be very curious to me if there's this ancient philosophical problem that's been a problem forever. There, I'm pretty sure compatibilism was invented to deal with this problem. Yeah. And then to then say that, oh, it turns out that everyone is naturally a compatibilist, would be very curious to me. It wouldn't make sense that there would even be a problem. Someone would have to come up with this incompatibilist version of free will, introduce it, and then that then become the problem. You know what I mean? That seems a little curious to me.
Well,
and also, sorry to say one more thing.
Yeah, sure.
Dennett does say Sure, everyone, you know, Dennett grants, though he does cite this study, he also grants, yeah, sure, everyone's wrong about their version of free will and sure, this, et cetera, but I've got a better one and you know, compatibilists have a better one. He sort of speaks in that language too. So it would be, that's another reason why I'm a little skeptical of this, to find out. Yeah.
We got two things going on here, right? So first you're saying how could, as it's classically called, right, the philosophical literature, how could the problem of free will and determinism have arisen if people didn't see there to be a problem at all along here, right? That's what you're saying. Like, isn't this kind of weird that would happen?
Sure, yeah.
Well, my immediate response to this would be, well, recall how we said that this is really complicated and kind of subtle, right? That would, I believe, explain why. Because, no, it was never obvious, right, that free will was incompatible with determinism, nor was it obvious that they were compatible. I think that all along this has been a difficult problem that may involve an array of rather messy and competing intuitions, and that also does centrally involve our everyday experience of free will. And there are some features of our everyday experience of free will that I think maybe, right, get some folks thinking that there really is a problem. When we're doing stuff, we are certainly unaware of all the causes that came before, right? At the moment of choice and some sort of, you know, maybe we'll talk about like a close call decision here. These are the sorts of decisions that are often pointed to by incompatibilists who want to really take and exemplify what our experience of free will might be like. And in particular, that we feel that alternative possibilities must be open to us in order for our decisions and actions to be free. They talk about really like close call decisions. You know, you're like, should I, like something really important? Like, should I go on Thomas Smith's podcast? Right. This is a big deal.
Important, you know? To your career.
And it's surprisingly not an easy decision. You would think that, you know, who wouldn't want to go on Thomas's show? Right. This guy's great. It's friendly. Right. It's got lots of listeners. Lots of people like him on Facebook. Why not go? And well, there could be some competing considerations. It's like, well, you know, this guy's not paying me for this. And I could be doing something else with that hour of my time. I could like whittle it away watching, I don't know, Showtime or HBO Go or something like that. Right. I could take a nap. You know, it's perhaps not as stimulating, but, you know, I'll feel maybe a little better.
I'm going to have to cut this out or I'm never getting another guest on my show. Okay, there is so much more with Ryan Bourne, but we are at our limit for this episode. So tune in on Thursday for the remainder of the interview. Or if you're on patreon.com/atheist, you can get that as early as Monday, maybe Tuesday at the latest. So please do so. Also, I'd like to ask everyone who hasn't, please give me a review on iTunes. They've definitely slowed down lately, and they're really helpful. They up my rankings. I have no idea what's with the iTunes ranking system. It seems terrible because there are a bunch of podcasts that don't exist since like 2010 that have like three episodes that are above mine. So I'm likely doing something wrong that's causing this to be there, but maybe it's that I'm not getting enough reviews, something like that. I don't know. That's my only guess. It's highly frustrating, but you can help. Please write an iTunes review, or give me 5 stars, just click the stars, whatever you can, especially if you're not able to contribute in any other way. This is a totally free way. You can help me out, and it'll be great. Thank you so much, and I will see you guys on Thursday.